The reading is from Habakkuk, chapter 1 and verse 12 to chapter 2, verse 1. Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, you will never die. You, Lord, have appointed them to execute judgment. You, my rock, have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? You have made people like the fish in the sea, like the sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet, and so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet, for by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. Thanks be to God.
Well, I'll say again and welcome to our studies in Habakkuk. This is the second of those studies. Last time we looked at the subject of what was driving Habakkuk mad? And part of the answer, anyway, was the state of the people, God's people, Judah. Just to put that in context, I'll just put my timeline up again briefly, just to see where Habakkuk fits into the story. We don't know his exact dates. Some of the prophets actually say in their prophecy what king or kings were reigning when they were writing. Habakkuk doesn't do that. But we can work out from the context pretty well where he fits in. It's clearly before the exile to Babylon, which puts him as a contemporary, or at least approximately, to Jeremiah, and probably to Nahum and Zephaniah as well. And the problem with the nation was, he refers to violence and injustice and destruction. I said last time that Judah had had a series of good and bad kings, and I've actually color-coded them there. So the ones at the slightly darker orange with the underline are the good kings, and Josiah was the last of the good kings. His father Amon and grandfather Manasseh were pretty awful, left the country in a pretty dreadful state. Josiah brought about a lot of reforms, but sadly, when he died, those reforms were largely forgotten. So that makes it very likely that that is around about the time that Habakkuk was writing. But not only the state of the nation, but God's apparent inaction and indifference to that. And he cries out, "How long? Why are you letting this carry on?" And God responds with an unexpected answer. Unexpected, he said, "I'm going to say something, and do something that you wouldn't believe even if anyone had told you, because he was going to use very unexpected means. He was going to use the Babylonians to deal with the problems in Judah. Now, God himself describes the Babylonians in pretty awful terms. And so that's where we left it last time. How will Habakkuk respond to that? I've called it, "You cannot be serious." The NIV, the beginning of the paragraph, calls it Habakkuk's second complaint. Actually, I think that's a bit unfair, both on my part and that of the NIV. He certainly does find God's response hard to believe. But I described what he said last time in his first complaint as something of a rant against God. I think this time it's eased off at least a little bit. And he starts this time with what we might describe as a statement of faith. He seems to be keeping his faith, albeit it's challenged, but he's confused as to how to reconcile that with what he knows about God. His theology and what he's hearing from God are just not quite the same. And yes, he acknowledges that God is using the Babylonians, however strange that may seem. Martin Lloyd-Jones has an interesting illustration at this point, which I find helpful. He imagines someone walking on very soft ground, just trying to find solid bits here and there to move forward so that they can progress. And that's probably what Habakkuk's doing. He's just trying to get hold of something to enable them to move forward in what's a very difficult situation. And what does he learn about God? Well, he learns that God is the what he knows about God, God is the everlasting God. The world only exists because of his will. Compare that to the God of the Babylonians that we heard about last time, who even reckoned that it was their own power really was their God. Verse 11 said, referred to guilty men whose own strength is their God. God is the one on whom his people can depend. Note that he uses God's personal covenant name. When you see Lord in capital letters in the Bible, it's because it's translating Jehovah or Yahweh, the I Am, the promise to Moses. He refers to God as Holy One and Rock, the one you can truly depend on, the one who doesn't change. Note that he also uses the word my twice. Again, a reminder to himself of the covenant. Maybe a reminder to God as well about the covenant with Judah. And hence those words, "We will not die." He, in one sense, the people of Judah are safe, or at least won't be utterly destroyed. Yeah, correction, discipline, reformation, yes, but complete destruction, no. And of course, we know that the exile into Babylon was temporary, albeit a long time, and the people of Judah did return. He also notes that God is totally pure. But this statement of faith raises problems for him. There are a lot of apparent contradictions in what he believes and what God is saying to him. You know, we just read in verse 13 that he says, "You've got purer eyes than to behold evil." Well, he wants to start with that, but where does he go from there? Back in verses 3 and 4, he had said God was seeing evil in Judah and not doing anything about it. Now he's trying to depend on the fact that God cannot stand the sight of evil to perhaps deny that God could possibly use the Babylonians to carry out his punishment on the people of Judah. Back in verse 4,
He could not understand how God could apparently stand back and do nothing when the righteous were suffering at the hands of the unrighteous. Now he says, God's going to cause that very thing to happen. At first he acknowledged the sins of the people of Judah. Now he feels at least they're not as bad as this Babylonian lot. So how does that fit? Yet all that he knows about God means he has to accept that God will do nothing unrighteous or unjust, however it may look. He feels he needs to ask again, why? And verses 14 onwards, if I may use a different metaphor than he uses, it's as if God has set up his people as sitting ducks, vulnerable to what's about to happen. He says they've got no ruler, and that probably was almost literally true at the time. The kings following Josiah were pretty useless, and at least one of them was replaced by the Egyptians by a puppet king, so they'd no real ruler. They were flapping about, very vulnerable. And God seems to be deserting them to the mercy of the Babylonians, verse 17. And what's worse, verse 15, the Babylonians are going to enjoy it. How can God possibly allow that? And we know the Babylonians had a polytheistic religion, but we've already read and God has said that it's really their strength is their God. They're very arrogant in that way. So although they don't realize it, it is God who's raising up the Babylonians for his purposes. So their self-reliance is all the more idolatrous for that. And note in verse 16, they're enjoying the material benefits of their plunder. So in verse 17, Habakkuk asks much the same question as he did in his first. How long is God going to allow this to continue? Verse 17 gives a picture of the insatiable desire of the Babylonians to conquer other nations. But then the tone changes. Having made his second complaint, if we call it that, Habakkuk prepares himself, almost military style, for God's answer and how he might respond to it. When I read that, it reminded me of Psalm 73. You might remember the psalm where the psalmist is struggling with the fact that the wicked seem to be getting on okay. Healthy, wealthy, everything fine. And the psalmist is actually saying, it's actually no use being righteous. It doesn't pay. And then the psalmist said, and I'll read a couple of verses from Psalm 73. When I tried to understand all this, it was oppressive to me till I entered the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their final destiny. The psalmist went to a place where he could better see the big picture and see God's part in it. And I think that's a little bit of what Habakkuk's doing here. He's made his second complaint, and now he's standing back and said, okay, you answered me once. Will you answer me again? Well, will he? Well, we'll pick that up in a few minutes. In the meantime, we're going to sing and read the second bit.
So now we move on to chapter 2. And the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, and he will run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end, it will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come, it will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol, Like death, he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own. For how long? And loads himself with pledges. Will not the debtors suddenly arise, and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoiled for them, because they have plundered many nations. All the remnant of the people shall plunder you, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. And woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You have forfeited your life. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork respond. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, it is not from the Lord of hosts that people labour merely for fire, and nations weary themselves for nothing. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea. Woe to him who makes neighbours drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to the cities, and to all who dwell in them. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image, a teacher of lies. For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath in it at all. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him.
So now we have God's second response. Habakkuk may not like God's first response, but it's confirmed in the second. In fact, it's so certain that it should be written down so that everyone might know it. And probably, as you see, in the permanence of tablets of stone, the same medium as the Ten Commandments. No opportunity for Chinese whispers here. The die is cast, and people need to know about it. Writing on tablets of stone might indicate that the fulfillment is still at least a little way off. However, there is an appointed time. It may seem to be delayed, but it's coming okay. And we know, of course, that the actual exile into Babylon was limited to 70 years. That was revealed to Jeremiah. And it was that knowledge that encouraged Daniel in his prayer in Daniel 9, as the end of that period approached. But that's not the end of the story. The Babylonians are proud and wicked, but, and there's a strange phrase here, the righteous will live by his faith. It's quoted by Paul in Romans and Galatians in the context of our justification by faith and not works. It's also quoted by the writer to the Hebrews in a very similar context to here. And let me read just three verses from Hebrews 10. For in just a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous will live by faith. And if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who believe and are saved. So for the moment, in our day as well as Habakkuk's, it may seem like the wicked are having their own way, but that will not always be the case. Those who have faith in God will ultimately see the true end of things. Even now it's limited, and for God's purpose. Verse 5 is actually a difficult verse to translate, but in contrast to the righteous, the wicked worship material things. They're driven by greed, which might give some transient pleasure, is ultimately insatiable. Sometimes the purpose of conquest is to provide more land for one's own people and pasture for one's animals. But it seems that Babylon will never be satisfied or at rest. Although at the time that Habakkuk was writing, the Babylonians may have looked invincible, as did, of course, the Assyrians before them, God would deal with them also. What we see in the following verses, the remainder of the chapter, looks almost like a courtroom procedure with accusations and pronouncements of judgment, primarily against Babylon, but lessons much wider, lessons for all of us. And there's a series of five woes, and I'll just run through them fairly quickly. In verses 6 to 8, I've called it a woe against the plunderer. It seems that those who have been oppressed, and that would be most of the other nations, as well as Judah, will take up the same question as Habakkuk did at the beginning. How long? But in this case, it seems that eventually there's going to be a sense of confidence that wrongs will be righted. Note their reference to taunt, ridicule, scorn. There's an irony. The tables are going to be turned. There seems to be a play on words there. The word translated debtors is often the word used for creditors. It seems that the debtors will become creditors and will want their goods back with interest. And this does seem to refer primarily to the defeat of the Babylonians in the days of Belshazzar by the Medes and Persians. The Medes and Persians, we read in Jeremiah, had previously been victims of the Babylonians, but they in turn would defeat the Babylonians. Today, the site of Babylon is a wasteland. Note the reference to destruction in verse 8. It's the same word translated violence that Habakkuk uses of Judah back in verses 2 and 3 of chapter 1. And of course, Judah was then defeated and exiled by the Babylonians, who in turn were defeated by the Medes and Persians. Secondly, a woe against the plotter of ruin. Woe to those who build their material wealth and importance by the unjust treatment of others. The word there can be house or realm. It can even be dynasty. In this case, to the extent the Babylonians feel impregnable, safe from any danger. Even God? They sought glory by what they've achieved. But there's irony here too. They bring shame on their own house. The word translated their house is the same as translated realm in the previous verse. And verse 11, the very structures themselves speak out against them. Next woe, woe against those who shed blood. The very foundation of the Babylonian Empire is violence. So, another woe to those who get material gain by violence against others. In fact, by any means. Material gain is only temporal. God has determined that. There's actually a very similar verse to verse 13 in Jeremiah, which is specific to Babylon. The buildings in Babylon would, in due course, be destroyed. The ultimate truth, verse 14, is God's glory, short term and long term. And he's promised to make that known to his people. You might recognize the words of verse 14. It's the words in a hymn that some of us remember singing at school. We're going to sing three verses from that at the end of the service. Then the woe to those who degrade or take advantage of others, whether this is literal or figurative or both, doesn't really matter. There's a picture of the wicked encouraging others to join in their wickedness, but then taking advantage. But it will be turned back on them. Drinking's a frequent picture in the Bible of excess, not just alcohol. It's also a picture of God's wrath. And we know from Daniel 5 that Babylon's end came while they were indulging in a drunken orgy. The word translated disgrace in verse 16 appears only here in the Old Testament and literally means vomit. So the picture here is probably of the Babylonians lying drunk and naked on the floor in their own vomit. Verse 17. The Babylonians had devastated beautiful Lebanon, literally. But this is probably just a picture for the wider geographical area violated by the Babylonians. It probably also implies that the Babylonians went much further in their violence than was necessary just to conquer the human population, destruction of the environment, and animals too. But again, it's interesting that the word used for violence, destruction here, it's the same that Habakkuk used of the unrighteous Judeans back in verse 3 of chapter 1. Finally, a woe against those who worship idols. These people are putting their faith in something useless. I've already said that effectively the Babylonians worship their own abilities. This final woe sums up what has gone before. The real sin is idolatry. Ignoring God. Putting God out of the picture. And this emphasizes how ridiculous idolatry is. An idol might look attractive on the outside with its gold and silver, but it's lifeless, useless for giving teaching or guidance. Three different words are used here. You know, it's carved or made and cast, dumb. And after deriding the idol, the woe was directed to those who worship it and seek guidance from it. But there's a but. In the last verse. After all the, if you like, frenetic action of the previous verses, but be quiet, everyone. Habakkuk concluded with all his understandable questions, just take this in. In contrast to dumb and lifeless idols, God is sovereign and in control. Think about that and live in the light of that. There's probably an implication here that God is going to judge the nations, but the answer that Habakkuk needed and we need to hear is be patient and let God do what needs to be done in his time. So how will Habakkuk respond to this? I'll see you in 3 weeks' time, I hope.